Thank you very much, Leslie. I should say I've been at Athabasca nearly 28 years, but the centers were formed, I think, in the 90s, but this is all prehistoric for many of you. Now, my presentation, as you see here today, is briefly entitled Social Networking Political Activism. The longer title is The Great Canadian Copyright Fight Over Our Not. And what we want to, I want to do today is give a presentation in terms of how new social networking tools, Web 2.0 tools, were used in a domestic context. Now, I should say, in terms of this research, this is part of a larger project that Elizabeth Smythe, who is here today from Concordia University, College of Alberta, and I have been engaged in. We gave an earlier presentation on our work in Germany in November of 2008, and basically this is a part of that presentation. What we were doing there was comparing the use of Web 2.0 tools and social networking for transnational or global movements versus how they're used in a domestic context. So I simply chopped off a smaller piece of that. It's still, I think, quite extensive. Now, I just want to start with by reference to the notion of karaoke versus an orchestra. And I think you'll see why this is significant. Karaoke comes from a Japanese word, empty, which is a form of entertainment which amateur singers sing along with recorded music using a microphone and a public address system. Now, I think we're all familiar with the notion of karaoke. It's become quite popular in North America. With karaoke, the amateur is able to put themselves on public display and indulge their desire to sing. The orchestra, on the other hand, is much more professional. It offers music created by a tightly disciplined, coordinated, and highly trained group of professional musicians who usually perform at formal music hall. Their work is taken as very serious and important. In many ways, these two approaches provide a metaphor for at least some of the debate surrounding Web 2.0 and the new era collaboration and participation is supposed to herald. On the one hand, you have extreme critics of the new tools of the internet, especially social networking, who denounce it, Web 2.0 and social networking as really as the cult of the amateur. This is the title of a book, a recent book by Andrew Keen, who looks at those engaged in this activity as self-indulgent and engaged in trivial activities. On the other hand, you see there are those such as Tim O'Reilly, Claire Shakey, that claim Web 2.0 is heralding a new era of digital collaboration, creativity, participation, and ultimately democracy. Now, are these latter claims accurate? In part, this is what we want to consider today. That is, I want to examine these claims in the context of the Canadian grassroots mobilization in 2007 and 2008 against changes to the Federal Copyright Act. These revisions would have privileged producers and owners of copyright intellectual property over users. Its opponents claim that this legislation would have led to an attempted enclosure of the informational commons and the normalization of the web and corporate control over cultural production. Now, much has been made of the rise of Web 2.0 and its potential to usher in a new political economy of production, often described as user-led production or produceage, as it was described elsewhere, a word that's a bit difficult to explain. I'm not explaining to pronounce. But look at the old model of production. In principle, you have distinction between producers, distributors, and consumers. Each is clear and distinct. Now, this is the industrial model of production. But when you come to a digital era, these distinctions collapse. And this is supposed to be a circle. It's not quite there. but where you'll have a collapse between these categories, where producers can become distributors and be consumers. That is, one can produce, co-develop, distribute, and consume all at the same time, rather than having a finished completed product as you would under the old model. The product in the digital world is always undergoing further improvement. This is very much in terms of the open source model of production. So there are important political implications of protochage that O'Reilly claims amounts to an architecture of participation. Among these implications is that the Web 2.0 is leading to a more bottoms-up informational democracy thanks to certain features such as blogging and social networking. There is a certain vagueness, however, where these new spaces of politics are going to appear. One tint of our research was to inquire as to their use in a domestic, national Canadian political context. Now, I would like to begin first by offering some definitions of the web and then identify some of its characteristics. That done, I question how much of Web 2.0 is really new. That is, I argue that while there are distinctions between Web 1 and Web 2 that are useful analytically, historically the differences are blurred, that Web 2.0 is historically derivative of Web 1.0. That is, Web 1.0 has a history. And later I examined the Canadian campaign against reforms to the Canadian Copyright Act, a campaign in which Web 2.0 tools and social networking played, I think, a very important role. Now, in terms of definitions, Tim O'Reilly, who is really quite an entrepreneur, really coined the term, and you see its usage there in 2005. And this is the standard definition that everybody refers to. It's quite cumbersome and quite long. But you see some of the basic features: open source, continuous improvement, self-production. Key to O'Reilly's notion of Web 2.0 is the ability to build networks that connect individuals and organizations within the community, where information is shared and adapted and updated by all the members who choose to participate. Now, compared to O'Reilly, David Silver's definition, our view is much simpler and I think a little more elegant. And he says that Web 2.0 sites are less about lectures, that is broadcasts, and more about conversation, more about participation. So the question is that how do these participations occur? How are they performed? What tools are used? Again, I think we're familiar with many of these. There are collaboratively produced content via wikis, and I'm referring here to wikis and not Wikipedia, blogs and RRS feeds, applications that access the web as a platform and not the PC. And here we're talking about services that can be or spaces online where you can access, share, distribute, and remix content. We have folksomonies, by that referring to social tagging. We have Delicious, for example, a means by which you can bookmark pages. Flickr, where you can store, share, sort out, and search pictures. And YouTube, tagging videos. Next, we have mashups, hybrid technologies and services, where two or more technologies or services are conflated into completely new novel service. And finally, we have social networking services, MySpace and Facebook, to name two. Much has been made of the extent to which Web 2.0 is new and has affected the capacity for collective action and democratic participation. People such as Silver question this. He argues that while Web 2.0 offers hope, it has too much hype and too little history. Silver's observation cautions us against an uncritical, if not romantic, embrace of Web 2.0, suggesting it is an exercise in clever marketing. And we see this ourselves in the university. Somebody's got this 2.0, somebody's got this 2.0, and I've gone beyond this, I have 3.0. So it's a way, in a sense, of self-promotion and marketing. And it just a contrast. This is often you see as the dichotomy between the two, Web 1.0 versus Web 2.0, one static, one's dynamic, content created by web coder, Web 2.0 is by everyone. But, you know, somebody who's lived into the 90s, ever had children, might dispute this. I remember our son wanted to create this lawn mowing service, so he created his own web page. He didn't go through a web coder. We did have to tell him he had to be specific to Edmonton, that he didn't want calls from Hong Kong. But he created his own and content. So much of this and the argument is that many of the claims about Web 2.0 were actually claims about 1.0, that was democratic, horizontal, participatory, people could create content. And if you look at one of the claims, observations by a number of theorists on the network society, and I'm here referring to the work of Manuel Castells, and he said in 1996, with these new technologies, users and doers become the same. Thus, users can take control of this technology. And he also argued that the new digital technologies were undermining traditional industrial organizations and bureaucratic organizations and leading to new forms of organization where information and production took form in a manner of continuous development and improvement. So again, this is a claim in 1996. Pierre Levy, who teaches at the University of Ottawa, mentioned claimed in 1997 in his book, Collective Intelligence. It was really a book about collaborative working between people. So again, the claims are rather old. And in terms of practical purposes, examples historically about how the internet has fostered democratic activity and collaboration. One can point, and this is the work that Liz and I have done for the last 10 years, and this is something we did in 1999. We examined the multilateral agreement on investment, and then later on the Seattle meeting of the World Trade Organization. And we found examples of collaboration and even forms, you might even say a crude way, a means of wikis. Canada led the way, particularly in terms of MAI, and I think it was Steve Shrivman put out an analysis of it. And this analysis of what the implications were of the MAI were distributed all over the world. They were then recrafted within the local context, say in the Australian context, and then sent out, and other people would recraft it elsewhere. And I think this is a bit more elementary version of sharing and the concept of a wiki, but it was there in the late 90s. Now, Kleiner and Wirick make the point that there's nothing new from a technical or user point of view in Web 2.0, which does not have its roots as not a natural development from Web 1.0. Then the internet has always been about sharing between users. Moreover, Klein, Wirick, Zittran, Silver point to a darker side of Web 2.0 that you seldom hear referred to, and that is its potential enclosure by corporate forces. They're referring to its use in terms of data mining, use in terms of surveillance. And Silver particularly warns that the goal of control by web-based platforms, by corporation, was essentially consumer, the user. So there's a heavy commercial undertone to Web 2.0 and the various tools that are often ignored. Now, I would like to put this in a somewhat larger context, and I've already mentioned that Web 2.0 is divorced from history, and it's also divorced from considerations about a digital divide. It's often assumed, and I went to a presentation last week about new web design at Athabasca. There was a seminar at West Edmonton Mall. But the tenor of the discussion is such tools as Web 2.0 and Facebook are universal and everybody's got them. The point is that they don't. that the whole development of ICT, that information community technologies, has occurred within a context of inequality, which is very complex, multi-layered, and dynamic. In fact, there's not one digital divide, but many. We have digital divides within countries, and we'll see that a bit later, between men and women, between the young and the old and the elderly. There's difference between languages, and there's differences between ethnic groups. So I think it's important to put that context. But you see, North America, we have a very large penetration rate. Africa, I think it is a bit optimistic at 5.3. I've seen rates as low as 2% for Africa. Now, again, if you look at the total numbers, given the large population, Asia has considerable numbers of users, people who are on the Internet. Now, just come to the next slide, and it's referring to specifically to social networking sites. I should also, I'd also like to mention that there's a recent paper I read by Rafael Cardera, PhD student from Italy, who he documents in terms of culture production that the overwhelming, in terms of the web, the overwhelming amount of cultural production comes and is dominated from the United States. So when he claims that the content is all out there on the web, most of it is American. Now you do see there are different types of social networking sites. There's just not one, and they have different places in the world where they're active. MySpace, which has more youthful constituency and more, a little bit more working class constituency, is dominant and very strong in terms of its numbers in North America and less in else parts of the world. Facebook is very strong in North America and is trying to become global, but given the culture of particulars of networking sites, it will probably be quite difficult to go global. A site like Orkut is very strong in Latin America, very strong in Brazil, and very strong in Asia, particularly in India. So the social networking globally is very fragmented and in many parts. Now, the next section of the paper, I just want to discuss how the Canadian campaign played out. So I want to discuss how the issue of copyright emerged as a political issue, what role web tools, particularly Web 2.0, played in mobilizing resistance, and the global and international roots of this struggle. Now, you can see from this table that Canadian connectivity is very high. It's 84%. So Canada would seem to be a good candidate for a web-based campaign. Now, much of the campaign of resistance and mobilization was a transparently discursive one. It was a battle over framing of the issue, how the people downloading, file sharing, how they would perceive. Now, that copyright would emerge as a major political issue surprised Canada's minority government, but the signs in 2007, but the signs, I'll take questions at the end, but the signs of change were apparent long before. Copyright has long been historically contested. Few people realize that the VCR came within two votes of the U.S. Congress of being banned. So this was a huge fight at one time, but it was really a fight within a narrow range of participants. But unlike previous struggle, new digital technologies mean that copyright has become just a part of everybody's life. Today, in the internet age, copying, distributing, producing digital materials has become very easy and efficient for any users. So what were once fairly narrow conflicts over copyright have morphed into larger, broader-based public struggles as the boundaries between producers and users disappear. So I just produced a slide, I hope you can read it, a little bit of a history. 1996 is a very important date. This is the World Intellectual Property Organization. December of that year, Internet Treaty was concluded amongst a number of nations, establishing international norms, ones very favorable to industry, the entertainment industry, to guide domestic legislation protecting copyright. Now notice, Canada never ratifies the treaty. Participates, but does not ratify the treaty. In 2001, two departments of government, Industry Canada and Heritage Canada, hold cross-country hearings on copyright. In 2004, a parliamentary committee suggests rewriting of Canadian copyright law to bring it in line with WIPO norms. In 2004, the Canadian Supreme Court rules that file sharing is not illegal in Canada, and the proverbial SHIT hits the fan as far as Americans are concerned, because there's really a broad license for people to do what they wish with material online. The American ambassador protests, the American government, U.S. trade representative protests to Canada. Microsoft says they will never come to Canada if this legislation is not changed. The entertainment industry is really upset and they protest in Canada. So in 2005, the Liberal government gets the message. And they bring in new legislation, Bill C-60, to codify Canada's adherence to WIPO norms. But the legislation dies. There's a minority government. In 2007, the Conservative government starts the process, after more urging from the Americans, of preparing new copyright legislation. And in 2007, Michael Geiss launches Fair Copyright for Canadians Facebook, which grows very rapidly. So it was a long, protracted and messy fight and struggle over copyright. Now, in the fall of December of 2000, Guy sees that the legislation is coming forward, so he launches the Fair Copyright for Canadians Facebook. And this is a web page of it. It's talked about the end of Bill C-61, we'll get to later, but you can see all the chapters that are organized by regions and by cities across the country. Now, when this first came out, within 24 hours, it had gone from 50 members to 1,000 members on Facebook. And here's the actual site. Within a week, 10,000 people had joined. So I would like to stress, and the last slide I think indicates this, the organization by chapters. And the organization by chapters permits the struggle by copyright to be fought on the ground in terms of lobbying MPs. So this is not purely an online struggle, it's an offline struggle as well. Another important thing that happens in December at Christmas time is, and this was organized on Facebook, was that a busload of people from Edmonton, a whole bunch of people from Calgary, arrive at Jim Prentice's Christmas party. They crash it, take over the party, the reporters all are there, it hits the press. What was invisible in terms of press coverage all of a sudden has a lot of coverage. And Jim Prentice is a bit shocked at all this, he's stunned, and he withdraws the legislation for reconsideration. But little changes. In fact, it comes back in June of 2001, and government introduces new legislation, Bill C-61, which appears to offer few concessions to activists. So within days, the number of people on Facebook go up to 91,000. So 91,000 people sign up within a very short period of time. Now, in its latest incarnation, Bill 61, as the activists saw it, was, again, attempt to normalize digital technology and internet. That is, to bring it under corporate and state control. Bill C-61's attempts at normalization are particularly evident in the bill's anti-circumvention provisions, which would have prohibited users from overriding or breaking digital locks that prevent use or use of digital content. Now, I'm just going to show a short video. This came out as a contest that was featured on the Geist website here, which I'll show you shortly. Okay. So here we have the first video.
Copyright legislation has so much impact and a lot of people just don't know what to do. Are you going to be able to back up music or movies that I see or ask which you really something to a $20,000 fine. This one is limited to media, but anything with a digital law. This one is just because you bought something doesn't mean you own it.
The government has not thought this through. How will they ever prosecute?
You've got to be able to find the evidence, and that involves asking what people are doing and trying to get their own.
B64 doesn't give a damn about time. It allows for the creation of an online trade brother.
You are citizens of a digital realm, and you have rights.
Well, we're going to have a fight to protect these rights. We learn more to online if you're talking rights for Canada.
Okay, so you get a little bit of promotion there for Michael Geist. Okay, let's all go into the next one. And this is the runner. The next one is the runner-up. There's a contest across the country on making a video within 60 seconds. And this is the third one. This is the only French entry. So go to your MPs on the site. You see the Facebook site is there. Okay, and then one more. This is the second one here. This is an angry young man. So you can obviously he's quite upset there. And if you'll notice that many of the makers of these videos, and there are many, many dozens of videos that I could have referred to, they're produced by young people. Now, there's one video, the last one in French, referred to its implications for educational institutions and libraries. And if they had been implemented, they would have profound effect for distance education. It would have meant that materials would have been destroyed. Any digital materials would have been destroyed within 30 days, and the institution would have to have seen that these materials were destroyed by their students. So the Bill 61 stimulated the largest online protest in Canadian history. Now, as part of the analysis, we did a number of things. The first one is what we call a co-link analysis. It's, I'm sure it's not that meaningful from your perspective, but what it does is indicate who the primary players were in the network, who is linked to whom, who are the dominant who are the dominant players. And when this is live, when it's on your own set, you click on one and it shows who's linked up and who's linking to whom. So what I did as part of the project was to have a content analysis and just go put up a number, very elementary, put up a number of WebPoint 2.0 tools and just see how they're used. You'll see that the Michael Geis site uses blogs, blog links, RSS feeds is quite rich, podcasting, folksomonies. But most of the others are simply blogs. They're quite simple. Nobody uses a collaboration in terms of a wiki. Now, the Geis site, again, is a very dominant site. If not the, it's the dominant site. You can see at the top, Geis is there at the top. He has a very rich blog. Almost everything's on it. He's a professor of copyright law, a Canadian chair at the University of Ottawa. And still, you wonder, how does he get the time to do all these things? He also travels all over the country. Chair is a bit different. Here's some of the things that appear on the chair, on the site. There, Athabasca University VP on C61. Well, Roy is not quite a VP yet, but he's promoted by Michael Geis. But you can see Roy's presentation from his article, editorial in the Edmonton Journal, which came out last summer. And Roy has been quite involved in the process of exposing the limits of Bill C-61. Now, what Geis does is he produces a mashup. That is, what people want to do is they want to penetrate the old media. So this is a representation by these kind of orangish symbols of press coverage that has been negative about Bill C-61. And you can see by spring, summer of 08 that most of the coverage in the press is negative when it comes to Bill C-61, which is quite a remarkable retribute to, in fact, to the campaign, because it started, it was completely invisible. So the primary tool is the blog, which should come as no surprise. Another important distinction here, and we may discuss some of this, is dominance by English-speaking Canadians. French Canadians are active in the protest movement, mostly as students, professors, and librarians, but no French-speaking actors placed in the top 15. And I tried a variety of ways, even overloading it with some French sites I had seen entered into the, in terms of trying to create a map that would show some presence of French Canadian sites, and I didn't find any. There are some sites that are bilingual, so in a major way we have a cleavage, the Canadian cleavage between English Canada and French Canada. Now part of this may be the fact of the presence of Facebook in Quebec. In Quebec, only 12% of the population uses Facebook, compared to 30% of the neighboring population of Ontario. And overall, the Canadian rate usage is 25%. And these are stats about from a year ago. And there's another further geographical breakdown. Most of the key actors can be found in Canada's largest province, Ontario. And public opinion in Ontario and the Western provinces was very much against the bill. But in Quebec and the eastern-speaking provinces favored the legislation. So there's a difference between East and the West. Again, the primary vehicle for mobilizing public opinion was Facebook and the Fair Copyright for Canada, which had a rich mixture of Web 2.0 features, discussion boards, blogs, videos, a number of other features. Again, the Facebook had national and local chapters. Now, the protest against copyright legislation has been a discursive one, primarily online, in terms of those protesting the legislation, and it's about the use of rhetoric. So on one hand, we have opposing sides, a disciplinary rhetoric and an oppositional rhetoric, or resistance rhetoric. Now, the disciplinary rhetoric is almost entirely offline. It's that's the rhetoric put out by the copyright, the entertainment industry, the American government. And basically, we're talking about the internet is seen as untamed, as composed of potential deviants. Those who go out and file share are seen as digital pirates. They're seen as thieves. So a representation here. And this is a reaction to part against it. This is what is truly sinister here. We are all assumed to be pirates. And there's considerable indignation in terms of you looking at the debate or the discussion that occurred on the Facebook site, which is a rich source of research. They're very angry about being described as pirates. But the other part of the rhetoric is, you saw this at the beginning, I own this book. I mean, I own this computer, I own this piece of property. So it's about consumer rights. It's not a challenge to capitalism, it's about consumer rights. But other issues appeared. One fellow mentioned privacy. Canadian sovereignty is a very important issue. As a matter of fact, when you're looking at some exchanges on copyright, on Bill C-61 on Facebook, the discussion tends to take place on sovereignty in screaming caps. People are really upset. Now, the representation of this is actually, this comes from appropriation art. A number of Canadian artists in favor, opposed to Bill 61, musical artists, came out with this comic book. And you saw some of the posters from appropriation art. They were actually stuck up around the building on the 11th and 12th floor. So I know there are other people out there interested in this. But here's a comic book. It's us versus the U.S., the battle for Canadian sovereignty. The evil emissaries of American interests try to suppress the fantastic freedom of expression fighters in Canada. So if we look on the left, we have Russell McGorman. He's a blogger. He's been in the open software business for many years. Charlie Angus is a former musician, and he's a member of the NDP. And he led the NDP in opposition to Bill C-61. When Bill C-60 came out, the New Democratic Party, all parties were in favor of it. Next we have Cory Doctorow. He's a well-known science fiction writer. He writes for Wired. He is he's a Fulbright scholar, long been an activist. Michael Geist. We have, I think it's Harold Knopf. He's a copyright lawyer. Laura Murray from Queen's University, and Stephen Page, formerly from the Bare Naked Ladies, and he's very much in favor of a new model of musical production. So these are the primary figures. Now, just to go back and the dialogue, it also became a bit more serious in terms of freedom and democracy, what was at stake. But what many other people proposed is that those who are proponents of Bill C-61 were really proponents of a dying industry. And it was somewhat like an act to protect the horse and buggy against the automobile. And it couldn't be stopped and shouldn't be stopped. We had to get on to a new model of production and get away from domination by the huge entertainment industry. Now, what happened in terms of the legislation is once again we had in the election, and the legislation died. But the federal government has promised, at least the conservatives promised in their platform, to reintroduce the legislation. And this is directly out of their platform. A re-elected conservative government led by Stephen Harper will reintroduce federal copyright legislation that strikes the appropriate balance amongst the rights of musicians, artists, programmers, and other creators, and brings Canada's intellectual property protection in line with that of other industrialized countries, but also protects consumers who want to access copyright works for their personal use. So the question is, will this be appropriate balance, or the return of the American zombie? Now, there is some suggestion that, or some hope, some glimmers of hope, that the government may not introduce it, new legislation. But we have to remember this is a conservative government. But what's been happening in the United States is that, and this was, I get this knowledge from a presentation by Tim Wang, H-W-A-N-G, and you can see Tim's presentation, very good for the presentation. It's just been put up by the University of Alberta website. He made this on February 25th, this presentation. I have to say the University of Alberta Library has just been terrific. They've been on top, the library has been on top of this issue and sponsored a number of series and sessions about their implications. What Wang claims is that the recording industry, Associations of America have announced they're no longer going to be suing young people and students for file sharing, that they're throwing in the towel. This is what Wang is claiming, that they're trying to accommodate a new business model and see if they can make money out of this. Now, a very interesting discussion took place yesterday on the CBC morning show, when they're talking about this issue. And one of the points that's made is that the U.S. had introduced the Digital Management Copyright Act under Clinton in 1998, which had quite strict penalties. And it the act has, there has been some suits, but mainly against targeting certain groups, and the fines $3,000 or $4,000. But this has not stopped one iota the level of a file downsharing in the United States. The law has been like King Canute trying to stop the tide, and Wang claims that the industry is starting to recognize this. So if so, that's a very important breakthrough. We should know this spring whether or not this is true, when we have the speech from the throne, where the federal government is going to introduce new legislation and what it will look like. If it does come through, we particularly have to look at, I think, those of us who are into distance education, what are the implications for distance educators? Because this would have had profound implications for distance education. Now, I just want to come back just to make some points in conclusion. Are the differences in Web 1 and 2 as major or consequential as they claim? And an argument is that we can think of these tools more in terms of a continuum, in terms of dichotomy, expanding repertoire, people use them in different ways at different times. The Web 2.0 tools seem to work well in the Canadian domestic context. They permitted rapid and viral spreading of connections, information, and awareness, and facilitated collaboration, reinforcing the role of place, still relevant to our daily lives as citizens. Few campaigns are online only, and this is certainly the case. There's an offline component. The existence of local Facebook chapters encouraged participants on the ground. Still, we have a divide between French and English participants. But again, we can ask the question, was this truly a campaign of amateurs? Despite what O'Reilly and others claim, hierarchy exists in Web 2.0 and within social networking. We must distinguish between the experts, and in any area of public policy, you have to ask people who are knowledgeable, must distinguish between experts who led the campaign and the many amateurs who participated in a variety of ways, from lobbying MPs, producing online content. And clearly, the presentation we've just seen were amateur. But the lobbying that took place across the country, this was done by amateurs, people for the first time getting engaged in the political process. And I happen to have gone when a number of the local people, the Edmonton chapter, went and met Rahim Jaffer, the young man named Corey. He's an electrical engineer. He admitted he knew nothing about politics. He made himself familiar with the Canadian political system, how it operated, how legislation went through. He had binders upon binders about the entire process. and he was extremely impressive. So this is the way a means of amateurs can really turn into at least quasi-professionals. But I think another important campaign question has to be addressed. The organization is very weak. If you go back and look at who are the primary websites, the primary people that everybody is linking to, they're composed of one or two individuals. They're not really groups. They're not entities that perhaps can cohere over time. And this is the big question. Can Facebook campaigns endure over time? And you might think of the struggles of social movements, of the rights to vote, of labor for civil rights, and current campaigns against trade investment for global justice. These are not campaigns of the moment. They take place over many years. They're campaigns, they're years of struggle. So the question is how adaptable is Facebook for long-term struggle? And I think that's a very important question to answer, and I don't think it's been fully addressed. And finally, we can look at the campaign really as a bit of a hybrid. It's part orchestra. You do have your experts, you do have your professionals, but it's part karaoke. But in the end, can Web 2.0's architecture of participation be considered perfectly democratic? And I'll just leave you with that that question. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Jay. Do we have any questions from the audience here? Okay.
Yes, Jay, that was very interesting. Just as you were closing there, it occurred to me that perhaps in the vein of deliberative democracy, we should be talking about some institutionalized methods of incorporating this kind of debate in the processes of government. In other words, something like, why doesn't every constituency have an official Facebook page, for instance, that anybody who perhaps identified as within that constituency could engage in this kind of a debate?
I think it's an excellent question. I'm going to raise one question, though, about Facebook, for example. Many people object to it on in terms of its intersection with its commercial use. They do so on ethical grounds. So there's that particular issue. But the Obama campaign, at least part of the promise of that, is in fact to start integrating those who are out there in cyberspace, making connections with government, starting to penetrate government. And there have been a number of discussions about this. There was a discussion last year, I think in 2007 in Berlin, about how to make connections between the World Wide Web and how it might lead to a new model of policy making, new models of government, which incorporated participation. I should say, though, that it would take a considerable change in mentality of government officials who prefer not to interact with the average citizen. I mean, that's their preference. But that's an excellent point. It does have that potential, and there has been some discussion about this. And I think the U of A is running an experiment about online deliberation using some of these social networking tools. So some of this experiment is taking place. Now, where was the next question coming from?
It wasn't a question particularly, but you might have an answer. You know, there's a question about the viability of Facebook campaigns. I'm going to leave that aside. I think the deeper question is about the effect that developing intellectual property law is, you know, having on our role as educators or as citizens. I guess it's really a question when you read about the enclosure movement in England, you know, around the time of, well, before the Industrial Revolution, whether you liked what you were seeing or didn't like it, whether or not property, you know, should become, the dominant question when people share knowledge and things like that. When I went to work for Athabasca University, I was impressed with the fact that unlike teaching in a bricks and mortar university, I would, when I wrote a course for Athabasca University, it became the property of Athabasca University. I couldn't go to Phoenix University and say, hey, do I have a course in industrial relations for you? You know, I wrote it for Athabasca University, but here it is. Whereas if I was teaching in another university, I could have gone and, you know, ostensibly deliver the same lecture anywhere I wanted. You know, it's a question of whether or not the users are going to have the right, whether the creators are going to have the right to continue using something. It's a question of whether or not our students are going to have the right to download and to continue using what they were given by Athabasca University when they took a course in the same way that they used to retain textbook and course notes, you know. So I see the intellectual property question as being the, you know, really the dominant one in all that you've said.
Yes, and that's, I don't want to get into intellectual property too much because I've been warned about the this is a bit of a swamp, and so going into copyright is a bit of a swamp in terms of complexity. But there was a production last summer, which I have from CBC Radio about who controls ideas, and basically this is what we're getting down to: who controls culture. And this is a struggle about the control of culture. Where should that control lie? Should be shared? Who should have it? And many who are engaged in this really see it as a potential form of corporate control and dominance over cultural production. And these are part of the schism underlying. This is part of the underlying schism, because you look at some of this, well, you know, it's people, young people just wanting their music, so what? But it's a much deeper struggle about our culture. And I think that's part of what you're alluding to, isn't it?
Well, sure. People are very angry about the possibility that somebody may actually be able to control the dissemination of ideas in that way. People were angry during the enclosure movement that somebody could actually, you know, claim pieces of land as their property and deny other people rights to use it. You know, I don't see much of a distinction.
No, I think that's the argument. This very much resembles the enclosure of a commons. And that's the intention in part. That's what many people see in this legislation.
My question is about...
And do we have a question for
a question comment on the Obama campaign, because I'm glad you raised Obama in terms of Web 2.0, Facebook, and that type of thing. What that campaign represented was extraordinary. It was sort of a coming together of social movements, Web 2.0, and Obama. It presents at one level as a social movement type event, but on the other hand, it is the Democratic Party, and he is the president of the United States, the world's biggest industrial and military power and all the rest of it. And my question is, the extent to which Web 2.0's use is going to be about the issue of control is going to be determined by the same types of things that determine control in earlier social movements. The question would be whether or not there is mobilization and organization from the base of society that can develop its own leadership and networking, etc., independent of the big institutions of society. And if, on the other hand, the extent to which this can be co-opted by institutions like the Democratic Party and institutions like the Office of the Presidency of the United States. And I have a specific question too, which is the digital divide. The statistics you have in the digital divide are, you know, it absolutely identifies that exists. Is the important thing, though, the trajectory? Can we identify if there's a trajectory of the narrowing of the digital divide in any of these different categories? So those are my two common questions.
Okay. Thank you for beaming in, Paul. Paul Kellogg is a tutor in political science at Athabasca University and a tutor in global studies. Now, Paul mentioned the use of social networking in the Obama campaign, and that's, I think, is a very important question. The Obama campaign did try to control the parameters of social networking use. The campaign, Obama's campaign, really was one of the more tightly controlled, centralized campaigns. It was very tightly controlled and run out of Chicago. So at the one hand, you have this hierarchy, and then you have this ability for this hierarchy to use this tool to mobilize others. So it was used by the Democratic Party, and I think Paul is hitting the nail on the head. Can people take these tools up
in a way so they're not co-opted, they're genuine and remain grassroots. And I think that's a very tough question to answer, Paul. Now, I should say I've done some research with a colleague, Dr. Peter Chin at the University of Sydney, on the last Canadian election. And what it indicates in terms of social networking tools, the last election, those who has gets. That is, the party, there's a structural imbalance and hierarchy in terms of social networking tools used by the dominant parties and their ability to be used by the more marginal parties, such as the Green Party. So, in a way, they become incorporated into dominant party use, at least in terms of political parties. So whether we get any independent use there is a good question. Now, in terms of ameliorating the digital divide, a lot more would have to be done, and Elizabeth Smythe, Liz might be able to speak on this a bit more. Ameliorating this, it's going to be very difficult for Africa. Africa's a long way from it. In terms of the divide between men and women, that's almost disappeared. Young women use it as much as young men. In terms of Facebook, young women women use Facebook more than men, but they use it for very social purposes. They don't use it for political purposes. So in some respects, the digital divide is eroding, but I still think that within Canada, there's a very strong digital divide between Aboriginal peoples and non-Aboriginal peoples. So some of these divides are still there, and I think they'll take a long time to ameliorate. And one of the places where the digital divide disappeared most quickly was in South Korea. And this did not come through the magic of the marketplace. It came through the intervention of the South Korean government, who invested a considerable amount of money. So almost all South Koreans are connected. They're some of the most avid users of the internet. They're some of the most politicized users. And we saw a presentation, I think, a couple of years ago by a young in Florence, a study of how South Koreans use the internet to help bring down the government a number of years ago. To ameliorate these differences really will, I think, necessitate public intervention in some respects. So hierarchy is needed to bring more democracy to the internet. You can say that in a certain respect. Alvin.
Yeah, Jay, I was wondering, you know, in terms of this divide between French Canada and English Canada, one of the things that came to mind, and you can correct me if I'm completely off base on this, is that, in fact, that there's a very different view in terms of so-called of consumption here, because yeah. You know, I mean, when you mentioned, you know, about this kind of Canadian sovereignty thing in terms of the English Canadians, I thought, well, this is pretty bogus. Here you have these English Canadian kids, you know, objecting to a kind of American-directed law that prevents them as Canadians from getting all their free American culture. Whereas in Quebec, where there's much more of a buy-in to the local cultural stuff, my guess would be that you know, these kinds of things that we know are coming from the producers of cultural stuff, both the artists and the corporations, you know, that you know, don't steal this from us. I suspect that in Quebec that argument goes over better because people, you know, do buy into their local culture. They know it's very vulnerable, that it's small, and that in a sense that there's a willingness to pay for it. I'm guessing this based on, you know, sort of past stuff where, you know, there's always this stuff of English Canadians won't buy the books that are produced here, go to the movies that are produced here and that, whereas in Quebec they do. It's almost like a social duty. So I'm kind of wondering if, in fact, what we aren't seeing in that gap is that these Canadian kids who led this, it's not just kids, but you know, these Canadians leading it, aren't in fact really consummate global consumers, whereas the Quebecers are real nationalists.
Well, the argument by the Bloc in terms of support of Bill C-61 was it would protect Quebecois culture. It was a means of protection. And so it wasn't perceived as a threat. Now, whether the base of that ties directly into your argument, I'm not sure. It well may. I think you would have to have, you know, some survey research. You would have to ask, you know, members of the Bloc Quebecois. But I have to say I've tried to interview members of the Bloc Quebecois, and they're not willing to be interviewed. So there's a certain difficulty there, but there are a number of people that were part of
the movement here against BLC61. So you might be able to penetrate these networks and ask some of these other questions to get access to some of these people. But why wasn't there greater presence in Quebec on this? And part of it may be for the reasons that you suggest, and it shows that the language has become a bit of a buffer for them, where it's not a buffer in English-speaking Canada. Yeah, I mean, I it's a valid point. I'm still not convinced what the answer is. Dale.
Just a bit of a follow-up on Alvin's and then a second thought, too. I mean, I wonder, too, if this idea in Quebec that or the suggestion that it protects their culture is not maybe a bit under thought out, in the sense of how is it going to protect your culture if you can't watch it, if you can't share it, watch it once, you can't share it, you have to delete it, etc. Then I also think about that Quebec and everywhere. If this law passes, it applies in Quebec, but it applies throughout Canada. But for the rest of the world who doesn't, or elements of the world who either don't pass such a law or don't respect this kind of copyright or don't enforce it, what you're going to get in education and other scenarios is various countries, pick on China, for example, because they have said that they're not following some copyright or drug patent laws. They'll just do their own. So you get a situation where other countries can share it and copy it and pass it around, and North America, Canada can't. And we pride ourselves, a lot of times we have this rhetoric about being leaders in the knowledge economy, but we're putting fetters on people from sharing any knowledge. I don't get it.
Yeah, well, that's part of the argument, and that's a very, first I'd like to come to the point you mentioned about the digital locks in Quebec. Yes, it will affect all Quebecers, and you can guarantee if a law like this was passed that things would hit the fan if a Quebecer found that they could not make a copy of something. They would be just as outraged as the rest of the country, and the Bloc may well feel the heat in that regard. So when it comes down to practical usage, most people, you could have your grand, if you made a copy for your grandmother, that's illegal, and she played it, both of you could be fined $20,000 each. So, you know, I think a Quebec granny would be upset as an English-speaking granny in that respect. So I think you would be much like a universal condemnation, non-adherence to temperance laws in the United States. You know, that there'd be widespread disavowal or non-adherence to the law. And I think that would take place in both cultures. So it does raise the question then, as you mentioned, to the extent to which did it really hit home with the Bloc that if this law comes through, what type of reaction are you going to get from your constituencies, and why did you vote for it anyway? Can you explain that? There's a number of conundrums I have. Now, in terms of other cultures, the Japanese are not, they're not paying any attention. The Chinese, I doubt if India would. So if you're talking about cultural innovation and you put clamps on innovation, that what you're really doing is putting clamps in really in terms of the influence of your particular culture around the world. And you're downplaying your culture, and you'll get a sterilized, homogenized corporate culture, which, as we can see from what's happening on Wall Street, it's really the worship of false gods that they're imploding. So there are real limitations to that if that model is to be incorporated into the dynamism of creativity and reproduction. And that's the argument of the people that are opposed to it. If you want to have a dynamic, productive culture, you've got to have it much more wide open than this bill would have permitted. Yes. Eric.
Yeah. Thank you. You know, probably I heard from Erwin, I think probably one thing is some in terms of the divide, the difference issue between English Canadian and French Canadian. I think there's one example, for example, in the corporate shareholder proposal, for the first in Canada, I think the first most influential shareholder activist is actually, I think, from Montreal, and his name is Yves, M-I-C-H-A-U-D, I don't know how to say it.
M-I-C-H-A-U-D. Yeah,
Michaud. Yeah. He actually, in 1997, took three Canadian banks, Royal Bank and the National Bank and the Laurentian Bank, to the court. Because those three banks, they quote the law of Canadian Business Act, said you cannot file the proposal. We just, you know, trash your proposal. That guy put the three banks to court. And he won. He eventually won the case. Then the law was, modified. From 1997 on, you can file shareholder proposal almost, quite freely. So that guy is French. So my opinion, probably, the difference between Canadian, French Canadian and English Canadian probably depends on the, on the topic, maybe on the content.
So you were saying there are vested corporate interests in Quebec who may have a real interest in terms of protection, in terms of Bill C-61?
My point is that, the difference between
French and English Canada.
Yeah, it maybe depend on the, on the issue. What's the issue at the table? So
on this particular issue, Bill yeah. 61, and so what are the implications according to what you're saying? And of course,
I think my understanding is that, the French Canadian and English Canadian, their opinion can vary from issue to issue.
Right.
For one issue, everybody let's say the two granny, English granny and a French granny, if you, fine them $2,000, probably the same reaction, whether it's a Canadian or English or Chinese, the same reaction, right?
Right.
But for this issue, like a Bill C-61, probably the French will take the attitude, who cares? English Canadian probably cares more. Then you go to the corporate shareholder proposal.
Right.
The French people actually they cares more on the corporate corporate democracy. The shareholder proposal. Look at the shareholder proposal.
Right.
They are more filed from people in control than in English Canada.
Right.
Yeah. So my point is that it really depends on the issue. So.
The issue related to a particular culture, and I think that's
the point
I was trying to make early on, that culture makes a big difference in terms of access, who gets engaged, and who participates, so that these particularities are very important. You have to unbundle them within any particular context. Leslie?
Yeah, I was just sort of reflecting in various ways as you were talking about the interests of the recording industry. One of my frustrations, and I'm going to just do a little personal aside that's not about the internet here, but it's about technology. If you get a mini disc recorder, which is made by Sony, they have made it impossible for you to upload your own work to your computer as a digital file. You have to go through analog and back again, because their bias somehow is that they don't want they only want to protect their interests in the recording industry. They don't acknowledge that you might have be genuinely producing your own material. So it's kind of an interesting little quirk that if you're a composer, if you are doing interviews, if you're recording live, real, non-corporate material, then the technology impedes your being able to deal with it properly.
Oh.
And... And
that's by design, or that's...
I do. And because of course everything you're supposed to buy from the industry, right? And another little aside, which dealt with the question of digital commons, not of digital commons, but of intellectual property as a commons. A number of years ago, at a common property conference, I heard an Irish ethnomusicologist complaining about the inhibitory effect of conceptions of copyright and intellectual property on pub culture, on pub sessions, because the recording industry was doing things like
charging the pub owners if someone performed live a copyrighted tune in the pub, and so then they, you know, that was inhibiting Irish culture about how music is to be transmitted and under what circumstances. And you find even large, big name recording artists in the Irish context, like Mary O'Donnell from Altan, who is flattered if someone takes one of her own tunes and thinks it's traditional and plays it in a session, but the recording industries for whom they work don't take that perspective. So this is interesting too in terms of this question of can we democratize the ability to share culture on the web now, or what will happen in terms of these copyright laws. You know, nobody seems to, of course it's not industry promoting it, but nobody seems to even be thinking about things that are produced by people who don't want to protect their intellectual property from other people using it.
Oh, and this is part of the new model of production that many people are talking about. I think there's a creative music musicians association, about 200 Canadian musicians, and what they're proposing is junking the old model, that they would be able to make their livelihood, a good livelihood, not through the corporate producers, who, by the way, skim off most of the money. I mean, this is a rather ugly industry to get down into what the industry is like. You just junk these people, and that you produce your own. And Lorena McKinnon is a good example of this. She's in charge of everything. She produces her own music, she markets it, but she makes a lot of her money, or she did, through concerts. That is, one would make their money through concerts. And there's evidence that you put your music out there online, it doesn't detract from sales. In fact, your sales can go up simply because it's out there and people see it and they want that copy. They like it. So there's no contradiction. But the emphasis will be on a different way of producing it, and a different way of making their money, and that is just in terms of that you would perform concerts. And what you're showing, though, is this divide between the owners and the creators, and the owners acting as if they're out speaking of everybody's interests when they're really speaking for a very particular interest. And how do you break through? How do you break through and push these to the side? Mark.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say, historically, the recording industry always got most of the money from recordings.
Right.
And performers got most of their money from live performance. Now, the recording companies could argue that we provide the recording studio, and therefore we develop the talent, you know, and that isn't quite as true anymore.
It's pretty thin reed, isn't it?
So this is really just cutting out the middleman. The idea that, you know, you have your own website, could be free, you could have ads on your website, but you basically just use that to promote your music, and then you make your money live. And the recording company is just kind of not as necessary as it used to be.
And that's what they're afraid of, being cut out. And the process is called disintermediation. That's a big, long word, but this was being discussed 10 years ago, how a lot of the middle persons or groups or organizations, institutions, corporations be cut out. And this process is well underway. And this industry might be one of the last trees in the forest to start falling in that regard. So we may be seeing the end of an era. It's going to be very interesting, though, if the Recording Industry Association of America can really throw in the towel and decide to join them rather than oppose them, and whether they can be successful at it. I mean, I would have my doubts in that respect. Alvin, was there any other?
I just had one other thought. Beyond using Web 2.0 tools to protest Bill C-61, I don't know enough about the web, but I wonder about some of his tools, but I wonder if you could almost use it, Web 2.0 tools in the future, to just make Bill C-61 irrelevant, in the sense that you go to China or India or somewhere and you have all the songs that are online and you just bookmark, kind of use a delicious kind of bookmarks, and you create your own play file, and you have an MP3 player that is satellite connected, and it just pulls from your list, and there's nothing in your possession.
Well, doesn't it have to go through your local ISP provider and what they know?
Maybe not necessarily if you use a satellite uplink to the Chinese satellite.
Hey, oh, and he's a lawyer, too. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so what you're saying, there are a variety of means around it.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to stop it or police it. I think that's essential.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah. I mean, how do you prosecute anyone when there's nothing on their computer other than the fact that I go to a website?
Yeah. Well, you'd have to police your children, too. This is where a lot of the violations occur. That, you know, the kids use your computer, and it's on your computer. You go across the border, and they look at it, which they're starting to do, and it's there. Okay, and they got you. So that's if you don't have children, maybe no problem. But if you do have children, I think you'd have a real risk in terms of what they're accessing at home.
Yeah.
So you'd have to be the policeman at home.
Here you have two things to share about China, the internet. Okay. Actually, in China, people are actually using the internet quite, you know, creatively. They actually call some people who, let's say that one government official, he was making a speech, and he wear kind of, you know, wristwatch, and, smoking some certain brand of, cigarette, and then people just zero in his wristwatch, and have a close up of his cigarette, or calculate, how much the expenses. Oh, this guy must be a corrupt official. But that's really, that guy was really get caught, and he was yeah. So there, I think there are some myth, conception of the internet usage in China. That's the one point I want to share. Another point I think about the middleman. You see, the middleman maybe just the last tree in the forest to fall. Actually, I think they find a new model, Amazon. So used to be, in a business model, you got 80% of your revenue from 20% of your products, right? Same thing can apply to our courses. But right now, they have the technology that can really use, they can really capture all the products. Even one product have a very tiny seal, they can still make money. But right now, they're able to capture the long tail. Usually you just capture, keep your eyes on the 20%. Right now, they are able to keep eyes on every single, the music, the CD. That's the way the Amazon, the online, retailer, and also the other online product provider, they're making their money. So they find a new model.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see in a short time in terms of what that new model, if it emerges, and what it looks like. Leah, anything?
Yeah, I had one sort of, reflection, query, whatever. Recently, I've been discovering that my Gmail mailbox is filling up with tons of advocacy kinds of emails. Obviously one list leads to another, and various people have decided that I am politically, supportive of it, their general perspectives. And a lot of those things have web links to petitions and stuff like that. Do those things really do anything? Is that actually making a change in the face of politics?
Well, we have a petition here. There's been polling done by the Pew organization. And the Pew, PEW, is a very well-established American organization. And the data indicates that most politicians don't pay any attention to an online petition. To begin with, if you're a politician and you're elected, say, from District X, mm-hmm. you get this petition. Well, are any of these people signing? How many of these people signing this petition are from your district?
Mm-hmm.
your constituency. Why pay any attention to it? What they do pay attention to is if they get a phone call, if they get a letter. They see if you put the time in to actually write a letter, sign it, put an envelope, lick the seal, put a stamp on it, you've actually put some effort into it, and they're going to pay a little bit more attention to it. But just to I mean, anybody can, you know, end poverty today, click, and, you know, I'm, you're not going to take that seriously. But if they get a lot of people with a lot of letters, a lot of phone calls, and a lot of questions in terms of, because it's old-fashioned politics that prevails with politicians, and that's where you have to do the groundwork. Now, that's very illustrative of something I didn't mention in this presentation. It maybe speaks to the youth involved. There was a question there, how can we gear this campaign up? And almost the entire discussion was about how you could produce the best videos for YouTube and get them out there. Okay? So they were speaking in terms of a form of connection, which had YouTube, you make fun of a politician, they're perhaps going to notice it, but to be effective politically, you have to do some old, you have to know what the issues are, you have to be well informed about who your MLA is or your MP is, you have to go through all those protocols, and they have to perceive you as a something serious, a substantive, and that could affect them in terms of the outcome. And we had this discussion with Raheem Jaffer, and he was starting to get it. He said, now let me give this analogy. For you people, the importance of the issue is important to my fellow MPs as the issue of guns and control over guns. I said, you've got it. Okay. But you had to sit there and you had to work through that in terms of an issue before them. So you can't eliminate the old-fashioned on-the-face, face-to-face, on-the-ground, face-to-face contact and things like a petition. I doubtful. I get so many of these things, and you know, I push them and I sign them, click the button. I doubt their use, and all the data shows that nobody pays that much attention to them. Yeah. Any? You want to ask a question there, Bob?
I was just going to come back to the use of these social tools for mobilizing. I wonder about their sort of misuse, or I'm thinking of an analogy like the talk radio, where you know you get these planned callers that come in, and on both sides of the fence as well. I wonder how much or when or these new tools will fall prey to the kind of exploitation that perhaps both sides engage in at times, you know.
Well, they already have. And that's already happening. In terms of our study on the Canadian, the last Canadian election, there's a party that a number of people I know here belong to. This party says, oh, they send out in terms of through Facebook, our man is on CBC today. Phone in some nice, good questions for him, would you? Okay. The Tories do that. Yes, that was the NDP. So all the parties are doing that. Our Tory guy is, you know, make sure you phone in. So they're already doing this. They're using these tools that everybody is on to set themselves up to look good. And somebody from the CBC asked me, and says, then how much is this genuine? He said, well, that's a very good question in terms of what they're getting in terms of callers.
What's not genuine?
Well, in terms of that, you're stacking the deck.
But there's a point of using that.
Well, you're not getting diversity in terms of the discussion.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the purpose.
Huh? Yeah. Well, you'll want to hear from more than one point of view from a particular group of students.
One hand clap.
Yeah.
I think you can almost tell, in fact, when you listen to a radio show and everybody's saying the same thing, that it's stacked. It's not spontaneous. I wouldn't take it seriously even if I agreed with everybody.
but I think I think the danger of the web or technology, there's a it imparts a kind of a credibility. I think for some, the uninformed or the less informed user is persuaded by technology and sees somehow the import of the message is more credible just because it is being distributed through technology.
Yeah, and this question of authenticity in terms of is a very old one. In terms, this has been debates been going on for many, many. Who's really out there and what they're saying, and are some people being gullible and are they accepting it simply by the nature of the transmission? They've it speaks with some authority and they accept. That's a real problem in terms of all forms, I suppose, of communication. But it's a particularly serious problem with web-based internet technology. I mean, this is really a core issue. Liz?
I just wanted to make a comment. It didn't come out very much here, but we've talked a bit as well about the whole commercialization of social networking spaces. And it relates to what you said about what's authentic and also, I think, Winston's point. I'm not so concerned about the political party that goes on Facebook and says, would you all call this, network or radio show? I'm much more concerned about the corporation that puts up material on YouTube or on Facebook that appears to be the, authentic voice of some individual or group when it's in fact a corporate marketing plan. And if you dig down on Facebook, you will see that a lot of the material on Facebook geared to advertisers is really selling them on how much access they have through the profiles of the users of Facebook, how much access they have to information about people so they can market to them. And we haven't really talked about that today, but that's another concern about social networking.
Yeah, this is it's a very serious issue, and I think there's a journal called First Monday, and there's an article or two on how corporations are using Facebook's for data surveillance, for surveillance of users, and use it in terms of their marketing tools. I mean, this is an issue that people speak in terms of proponents of Web.0, and there are many other social networking tools. There's a lot of them, I have to say, in this university, a lot of these people, that they don't get down to the level of asking these questions, particularly if you have any notion of asking their students to go on any of these particular sites. What are the implications when we're doing this? And that they're stripping this information from our students and really commercializing consuming our students in a very particular way. And we're not really discussing that issue, I think, in any depth at this institution. I really think that we should.
One really brief comment before we shut down, and it is 4:30, so it's about time to shut off the Illuminate. But I wanted to comment that when I told my partner that you were giving this talk and talking about things like Facebook and whatever and copyright, he said, is that about the whole furor about Facebook and copyright, which came up a couple of weeks ago, where it appeared that agreements suggested that anything you stick on Facebook, they can do whatever they like with. And then more recently, he pointed out that my Gmail has a really nasty user agreement in terms of what Gmail or Google can theoretically do with anything that I put on there, although it turns out that in practice it's limited in certain ways.
Well, think if you're a young kid, and you put you've had a great time at a party, and all those pictures appear on a social networking site, and they have ownership over them. And gee whiz, 5 or 6 years later, you don't want to be seen in the company of this young person you were actually with in that particular state, and you're looking for a job. You should have realized this a bit earlier. And so I think it's very important that, people have certain control and rights over whatever may be out there. It can be very, very damaging. I think particularly to many young people, don't pay any attention to this type of thing. But later on, it comes back to haunt them. Yep.
I think I'm going to shut down the official talk. Oh, yeah?
Add
okay.
to the Gmail comment, as many of you may know or may not know, we're moving Athabasca is to Zimbra, which is similar to Gmail insofar as your email will now be stored on a third-party server. So, like in the past, it was stored on AU's server, your email, and I think people were comfortable with AU protecting their interests.
Oh, okay.
But now, well,
what country will it be stored?
I don't know exactly, but I just know that it is it's a web-based server. So I don't know where the server is located, but it does mean that your email now falls under whatever agreement AU's made with Zimbra regarding email services. So, which has me worried since I do collect a lot of my email and have stored it locally on my machine, but you can't do that with Zimbra as well. All email, unless you forward it to a separate client to your computer, your email, all email content will reside on Zimbra servers.
Well, that is a very important issue we should raise. I mean, where is it stored, I think, to begin with? Who has access to it? And what would happen if, we saw so many corporations just simply disappear the last 2 months? What if Zimbra just collapsed? Something happened to it. What then? And got sold. What happened then? What have we signed up? Well, okay, next academic council meeting. Okay, we'll ask some questions. Hopefully the Faculty Association asks some questions. Thank you very much for all the... there are a lot of very good questions, and I thank you very much for coming. Yeah.
And thank you, Jay.
Down the Illuminate link then, and I'll
close it down here.
Right? Turn off the system. We can continue to talk, and we don't have to vacate the room instantly. But
I didn't know that about you. See, I'm a bit of innocent myself. I mean, I try and teach students to be critical. I never thought of that. I thought the universe.
Bob back.
Huh?
Bob keeps on top of this thing.
Well, it's only because I've been having ongoing problems.
What's part of the general problem that you know that